Okay, so this week's Parsha is Parsha's Toldot, and I think there's a really interesting question that comes up in the story very naturally. I think it kind of goes back to a very famous question, a very basic question in psychology of nature versus nurture. We have two babies that are born from the same parents, from the same womb, and they come out to be completely different people, complete opposites, namely Yaakov and Esav. So it sort of begs an obvious question, what would cause such a thing? And there's all sorts of, you know, in modern psychology, all sorts of studies that have been done on twins, but I don't know that you find, this is the paradigm of twins from the Torah, the first twins that we ever hear about. So we have, the verse that I wanted to look at. Maybe, Josh, you want to read the English, verse 27.
And Yud grew up, and Esau was a man whose understanding stood hunting, a man of the field, whereas Jacob was an innocent man dwelling in tents.
Okay, so we have a lot going on in this verse. First we have, and the youths grew up. In English, it doesn't really mean that much, other than they just grew in numerical years. In the Hebrew, we have the word vayigdalu hane'arim. And the root of that word is gadol. And when somebody is of great importance, is of great significance, they're often referred to as a gadol. That's in modern Hebrew, but it also has a lot of roots in the Torah, that the term gadol doesn't just mean chronological age, it also means a certain sense of magnitude and a certain sense of greatness. So now if you look at the Rashi's explanation, it's in gray, and the youths grew up. You can read that for us, please, in English. As we all wait for the holiness of the pizza to...
And the youths grew up, and Esau was, as long as they were small, they were not recognizable, though, through their deeds. And no one scrutinized them to determine their characters. As soon as they became 13 years old, this one parted on to the house of study, and that one parted to idol worship.
Okay, so it says in Rashi over here that until they were bar mitzvahed, until they were 13, they were identical in their face, in their deeds, in everything, in their entire essence. So sort of strengthening the question of what exactly changed, what was different. And now you're going to think this is for sure just society, because they were identical for the first 13 years of life. Everything they did the same. And if you think back to your own life, you're pretty much a developed person by 13. I mean, I'm quite certain that, you know, my children are all perfect and they're all way under 13. I'm just joking. But, you know, you definitely are a pretty developed person, so what exactly changed here? And then when we continue with the explanation of the different types of people they are, the verse continues that one was a man of the field, and one was an innocent man dwelling in tents. The dwelling in tents would mean is really like an allusion to a person that surrounded himself by the study of Torah and holy things, as opposed to in the world, working in the field and more worldly type of things. Many of you may be familiar with the story, but there's a famous story that when Rebecca was pregnant, she had a very, very, very difficult pregnancy. And Abby, you wanna read to us, we're gonna get back to that verse 27, but if we go a little backtrack to the opening verses of the portion, we have verse 22 over here.
Okay. And the children struggled within her, and she said, "If it be so, why am I like this?" And she went to inquire of the Lord.
You can keep reading the explanation of what it means the children struggled.
Okay. Struggle. Purpose. This verse calls for midrashic interpretation, for it does not explain what this struggling was all about. And scripture, "If it be so, why am I like this?" Our rabbis interpreted the word v'yiratzitzu as an expression of running. When she passed by the entrances of the Torah, academics of Shem and Eber, Jacob would run and struggle to come out. When she passed the entrance of the Temple of Idolatry, Esav would run and struggle to come out. Another explanation, they were struggling with each other and quarreling about the inheritance of the two worlds.
Okay, so what we're really going to focus on is the first interpretation, that when she passed by the place of idol worship, the place of unholiness, we have Esav in the womb, struggling to be born. And when she passed by the place of holiness and the place of Torah, we have Jacob in the womb, struggling to be born and struggling to come out. And she had constant turmoil within her. And so what does this speak to in terms of Josh, in terms of how nature versus nurture of these two little boys?
Kind of just saying that it's the nature of either one.
100%. It seems to be saying that one has this nature and one has that nature. Welcome, come in. Here's a handout. So that kind of seems to contradict the idea that they grew up and they were pretty much exactly identical in all ways until the age of 13. If from the time that they were in the womb, they were totally different. So how could it be both ways? How could it be that they were identical? And the first verse implies basically that it's nurture, that it's really more than just nurture, but it was personal choices. That they were exactly the same through their years of the youth. They had the same parents. Sometimes you say the children had the same parents, the same this, the same that, but they're 10 years apart, so the family dynamic changed. No, they had the same family dynamic, the same parents, the same everything. And nonetheless, one of them made this choice in life. I'm going to go into the secular world of hunting and gathering game. And the other made this choice in life. I'm going to stay in Kolo, and I'm going to stay in the yeshiva for the rest of my life. So that seems to be the implication of our first verse. But then when we go and we backtrack and we hear what was it like when Rebecca was pregnant, there seems to be a different implication. As Josh said, it seems to be the nature of them. One is jumping when it comes to learning Torah, and one is jumping when it comes to idol worship. So if we turn over the page, we have a very sweet idea that many of you may have heard before, that if you look, we'll go to the second source over here in the Gemara of Nida, that's the section, page 30, or section 30, the second page 2. It says here, a fetus is taught the entire Torah while in utero, and once it's born, an angel slaps its mouth, and this causes it to forget the entire Torah learned in utero. So what's the point? Anyone have any idea what the point might be? Why in the world would, even angels don't want to waste their time, why in the world would the fetus be taught everything only to forget it all? Absolutely, that you forget it consciously, but subconsciously it's there. Subconsciously you do have this retention of the idea, and that's why sometimes you'll notice when you learn an idea in Torah, there's like an aha moment. There's an idea, there's a feeling of recognition. It doesn't always feel like you're learning something you've never heard before, something foreign. Even if the idea is new, a lot of times people relate to ideas in Torah with a sense of recognition. So if you want to say that Esav, even though in utero he was one way and Yaakov in utero was another way, as soon as they were born, forget it. I mean, who remembers what happened in the uterus? It's not the reality of the world. Forget it. They started from blank. If you were trying to make that argument, we have here this Gemara to disprove that as well. That even if you want to say they started from blank, it's not really true, because what in the world would be the point of the baby learning the Torah in utero if in utero was completely pointless? Make sense? I think we might have glossed over that original question, so I hope it's clear. Make sense, Rachel?
Yeah.
So we're still kind of back to our original question of what was going on with these two. And then we have another question. I know this sticks out to me a lot, maybe because I'm a parent, but like, what bothers you about Esav, how he could have developed that way. Is there anything like in general, just a general question?
I think like each parent sort of paid more attention to one, like Rivka paid, Rivka paid more attention to Yaakov and, I mean, wait, did I get that right? Yeah, and Yitzhak paid more attention to Esav.
Okay. But what, is there anything that just bothers you in general about how Esav could have been so evil? Where did he learn it from? He had two, his parents were the most righteous people, some of the most righteous people that ever existed in the entire creation of the world. I mean, can you imagine? We're not talking about the most righteous people to exist, you know, today in history. And they managed to raise, like, where does that do for us? if the greatest, like the most, some of the most holy people ever managed to raise a child that was totally evil, what about a regular person with all of our regular flaws and all of our regular issues? What are we, you know, what's with us? And even further, we have a principle that comes up over and over again in Torah. Over here, where I wrote saying of the rabbis, it's something that we encounter. Helena, if you want to just read this first line over here.
The actions, occurrences in the lives of the fathers are a sign or root of the lives of the children or future generations.
Okay. The actions of the fathers are a sign of the lives of the children. Ma'asa avot siman levanim. So it means everything that happens in our lives comes from the root of that, the essence of that, the source for that comes from the lives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. A very basic example that we see that Abraham went down to Egypt when there was a time of famine, and then we see generations later, Jacob takes his entire family down to Egypt when there's a time of famine. And this happens over and over again. There are many repetitions. And so here we have it, a very strong Torah principle, that one second, Michael, that which happens in the lives of the first generation has a direct effect on all future generations. So where is the root for Esav's evilness?
Well, is this only on the macroscopic level of from the Avos to present day, or is it also on a microscopic level from one generation to the next?
I think it's on both levels. For sure, from the Avos to all generations. If it means that it's from the generation of, you know, a few hundred years ago to the generation of today, no. But the lives of the forefathers have an effect on each generation. Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
And also explain your question.
Okay. I'm not sure how in your head it explains my question, but I'm glad that makes you feel good. That's good. that means that you and I are on the same page. So we're just kind of still boggled. If we're going to say that Esav got it in utero, then we're wondering how in the world did he have the exact same life as Jacob for the first 13 years? And why does the Torah then have to go on to tell us that each child made separate life decisions? And if we're going to say that it's simply from his decisions and has nothing to do with what he had in utero, because in utero is in utero and life moves forward after you're born, then we have to wonder why in the world does it tell us in the Gemara that a baby learns all the Torah in utero, the meaning behind that being that it has a subconscious effect on us. So now we're going to go to something which I found very interesting. The Rambam over here. It says Rambam Shmona Prakim, chapter 6. Shira, you wanna read us? It's just two lines over here.
There are two types?
Yeah.
There are two types of people in the world. Chasad Hama'ula, whose nature is only to do good, and Kovesh and Yitzro, those who must conquer an evil inclination in their nature in order to do good.
Okay, so we have this from the Rambam, a ruling that we have two different types of people in the world. And we have a chasad ha-me'ula, somebody who's completely holy and their entire nature is to do good. And we have someone who's called the Kovesh at Yitzro, someone who has to conquer his evil inclination in the nature to do good. And in fact, it's not written in the Rambam, in fact, there's another type of person as well, the Baal Tshuva. And the difference between the Baal Tshuva and the person who has to conquer his evil inclination is that the person who has to conquer his evil inclination, he never does bad. He struggles not to do bad, but he never actually does bad. The Baal Tshuva actually did stuff that he wasn't supposed to do or she wasn't supposed to do and actually made a change. So if you have these three levels of people, the difference really is very simple. If you could take out all the philosophy for a second and just really boil it down, what's the difference between these three types of people? Anyone? The perfect saint that does everything, that doesn't struggle, the person that struggles but still never falters, and the person that actually did make mistakes but then changed their ways and now does not do that anymore.
I'm not very clear about the whole struggling one, but like I would say it's greater than the one who is born naturally having a tendency to do good and doesn't really have to fight any kind of inclination to do bad, and like, therefore they just follow their natural will.
100%. Like in a certain perspective, it is a reverse order of greatness. But I'm actually thinking just even more simple, just what boils down the difference between the three types, not which one is greater. Because from one perspective, the one who makes changes in their life is greater. And from another perspective, the one who is a complete holiness is greater because he's complete holiness. But they're both make perfect sense and they're both perfectly logical. But what makes, I guess let me just ask you the question, what makes the Baal Tshuva, let's say that level, the greatest?
What he does.
And what he does comes from inner strength.
Right.
Who needs the most inner strength? The Baal Tshuva. Who needs the least inner strength? Obviously has strength, but you know, doesn't have to utilize it in this capacity. Right, the Chassid Amula, good. So really, if we're going to boil it down, the difference between the three is the amount of strength that they need. The amount of strength that's fueling their life of goodness. And if we're going to talk about Yaakov and Esav, what was really happening is that Yaakov was like person number one in potential, the Chassid HaMa'ula, the one who does not have to struggle, the one who's complete goodness. And Esav in potential, and Yaakov lived up to that potential, and Esav did not live up to his potential, but his potential was to be the Kovesh at Yitzro, the one who overcomes his evil inclination. So he was genuinely born with a stronger evil inclination, and that's why in Kabbalistic sources, Esav is seen to be on a higher level than Yaakov because of what you said. Because his potential was greater, because he had the potential to fight to overcome a struggle. He didn't live up to that. So he did for the first 13 years of his life. He worked, and Yaakov had his life, and Esav hit his life, and Esav was constantly struggling and constantly conquering his inner self, and Yaakov was not. Yaakov was living in the way that he was meant to be living on that level. And then when they reached the age of 13, they each made life decisions, and Esav didn't give in, no longer conquered his inner will, and he began to give in to his desires for the hunting, just one second, Josh, for the hunting and for the life of evilness. And it's not to say that the hunting and involvement in the secular is what constitutes evil at all. What constituted evil was the evil things that he did. And Yaakov did not give into that because he didn't have that struggle. So we haven't 100% answered everything, but let me just take Josh's question
what
first.
What exactly caused him to switch up?
I'm not sure that anything caused him to switch as much as he just got tired of the struggle. The active way was the continual struggle. The passive way was just letting it go. Make sense?
Is it also the idea, like, the reason we come from itself? Like, guys come from itself, like, 13, maybe because, like, at the point where you enter manhood, like, you start to think more critically about the world? Like, maybe, I don't know.
Makes perfect sense in this context, that at that's the turning point of adulthood, and that would be why that was the turning point in Aesop's life.
Was Aesop always considered evil, or just when he became 13 like that?
So if you look at the first Rashi, when he became 13, that his life and his actions were completely identical to Yaakov. But we still haven't answered the question of where in Yitzchak and Rivka's life did they somehow plant the seeds for a child like Esav. Your parent ever look at you and say, how did I have a child like you? I mean, ever happened to anyone in this room? Noah?
All the time.
Or like you give your kids the worst curse you could ever give them. Like, I hope that one day when you become a parent, you have a child just like yourself. Yeah, I say that too sometimes. Because it's just like, how? And then from a positive perspective, sometimes I wonder about my kids, like, sometimes when they do something so sweet and so endearing and so special, like, why did Hashem give us this neshama? Like, we're just these two sort of people just hanging out in Queens. Why did we get this holy little soul that could be, you know, doing something amazing, if maybe in a different family? But hopefully we're giving our kids what they need. But I'm saying it goes from both perspectives. How did we get a child like this? So we still haven't answered, how did Yitzchak and Rivka and Isaac and Rebecca get a child like Esav? But we're getting closer by talking about Esav in a positive light. You want to take a stab at it, Holana?
I'm not sure. Based on what we said, maybe Yitzchak and Rivka, if we're talking about how a person might be judged greater if they fight their evil inclination. So I guess, like, Hashem gave Yitzchak and Rivka the, like, bracha, I guess you could say, like, the blessing of having children that could rise to an incredible potential. And it was really up to that child to be able to, you know, nourish it. So he was given, like, kind of like that extra test. And, like, he did happen to fail, but that might not have anything to do with Yitzchak and Rivka. It might have to do more with Esau himself.
Okay, so you're in a good general direction. If we're going to boil down the difference in the three types of people to essential strength, to inner strength, and like the one, the Baal Tshuva needs the most inner strength. The one that never falters but still has the constant battle needs the medium amount of inner strength. And the other one doesn't need to utilize his inner strength in this capacity. He doesn't do any sins.
So that's not Esav, right?
That's not Esav.
Oh. Okay.
But that was who Esav could have been.
Oh.
The thing is that. Yitzchak and Rivka had enormous amounts of inner strength. They weren't tested in the capacity of the Kovesh HaShitzro as the one who had to conquer their inner self, but they were tested in many, many, many other capacities of their life. Just like all the other forefathers were given enormous amounts of tests and very difficult tests. We spoke about last week the binding of Yitzchak being put up on the altar. We know that they all had very, very difficult tests in their life. So it was the strength that they garnered through life in the many tests that they had that was passed on. That's the root of Esav, was the inner strength that they developed through all of their tests, or that they not necessarily developed, but they also expressed through all of the many tests and challenges that they had in life. That's the root of Esav. The person who's born with an enormous amount of potential strength in order to conquer his will. And the truth is, that's for most of us who we can relate to, if we're going to relate to either one of these two types of people. The person who has, and I mean I speak for myself, but the person who has no inner struggle, there's very few people like that in the world. But the person who has a constant inner struggle doesn't mean that they do bad things, but it just means that they have an inner struggle and they have to think about it. That's the person that most of us relate to. And on different levels, because I once heard a very good example. If a person is observant of Shabbat their entire life, and it's meaningful to them and it's part of their life, and Abby, you're walking to shul, it's cold, and it's snowy, and it's uncomfortable, and your nose is turning red, and there's no Erev, so you didn't bring your gloves, and and shul is a good 10-minute walk, you're 3 minutes out of your house, you've got another 7 minutes to go, and somebody cruises by and offers you a ride. Are you tempted to get in the car? No. It doesn't even cross your mind. Because you're just, that's just, on that level, you're functioning like Yaakov. It's not a struggle. It's just, it's very, very deeply ingrained in your essence and in who you are that it doesn't cross your mind to get into the car. However, I don't know if I need to depict it as dramatically. I think we can all use our imagination. We do have encounters in life where we do have to struggle, right? Even if we're very holy people, there are times where we have to struggle. I guess maybe you hear like a really, really, really juicy tidbit of information about somebody whose clothes don't match. trying to keep it non-controversial. You know, it's whatever. I'm making a silly example, but you know, we all can understand that there are times in life when it's not so easy to do exactly the right thing, and we do have to struggle. So that's the sense of Yaakov in this world. And just to further the understanding of what the forefathers genuinely were, we have this quote over here. Rachel, you want to read from Bereshis Rabbah?
Sure. Forefathers are referred to as a Merkava, meaning a chariot. A chariot is symbolic of someone who is given over to a will beyond their own, just as a chariot goes in whatever direction is dictated by the driver.
Right. So if you could just picture, and try not to get, picture the Central Park horses that are, you know, being abused. But just the other day when I was walking home from Parsha class, I saw a really cute thing on campus, and I got like a little intrigued. And when I looked closer, it was like one girl pulling a wagon with another girl in the wagon, but like not like a red wagon, like a chariot type of wagon. And it said something like, it was supposed to raise awareness and sympathy to the Central Park horses. But
She was wearing a horse head,
right? And they had a sign. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but it doesn't seem pleasant to be one of the horses in Central Park. Yeah, and they don't have like proper stables. I think their stables are in apartment buildings, and they have to walk up the horses have to walk up a flight of stairs. It's a little bit sad when you start hearing about it, and you know, it raised my sensitivity to that. I already had known a drop about it, but you know, seeing it on campus, like, you know, there's a lot of things to be aware of and raise my awareness. So anyway, what's the idea of a chariot? The horse, you know, this is actually, it is actually relevant, the conversation about the Central Park horses, because even though the driver ultimately is the one in control, the horse itself is also a being. The horse itself has a degree of free choice. If not, you know, we wouldn't have people that are sensitive to the horses, right? The horse itself is a being and has its own life. But the chariot has absolutely no will of its own. It's 100% given over to the direction that it's being pulled in. Right? Nobody's rising sensitivity for the chariot itself, because the chariot is like almost like a non-being. It's completely and totally given over to that which is greater than it, namely the drive. Mostly the driver, but the horse is somewhere in between. So that's why the forefathers are referred to in this capacity, because they were totally and completely given over to the will of God. Which strengthens our question as how in the world could Esav have come from people that are considered a chariot, that are so given over to the will of God, it's not even like within their capacity to rebel against God. But how did we answer it? Anyone? I won't call on anyone, but anyone want to offer how we answered it? I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but how did Esav come from such holiness and such great people? What'd you say? The wheels fell off the chariot. Not exactly.
I think we said that he got like their inner strength kind of thing, but he just used it to the wrong capacity.
His potential strength, the strength that he was endowed with from birth to conquer his nature, came from the strength of the chariot. Even though he was a different type of being, he had a different way of serving Hashem in potential. All right, guys.